New
Love
you.
Talk Radio.
You. Today, we have Mark Charles, who's running for president of the United States, that we'll be interviewing. Thanks, Mark, for this opportunity to ask you some questions. Dean Val of Nations United Universal University sent me a few questions to ask you. So I'll start with question number one. And he says, your ancestors were able to live with the environment for centuries without harming what supported them. In the last 200 to 300 years, some would say science and technology has managed to make our lives easier. But to others, they have poisoned and polluted the food, air, and water we depend on for our survival. In your interview with SA, responding to questions from the third Democratic debate in Houston, Texas, a couple of weeks ago, you said we must prepare as a nation to take on the environmental crisis and most likely make some sacrifices. Can you please go into more detail how we as a nation would prepare to help offset the environmental crisis?
Well, Yate, first, please allow me to introduce myself and thank you for having me on your show. Mark Charles Yunus, yeah? In the Navajo culture, when we introduce ourselves, we always give our four clans, and we're a matrilineal people, and our identities come from our mother's mother. And so my mother's mother is American of Dutch heritage, and so I introduce myself by saying Sinbake Dena. Translated, that means I'm from the Wooden Shoe people. My second clan, my father's mother, is Tohiglini, which is the waters that flow together. My third clan, my mother's father, is also Sinbake Dena. And then my fourth clan, my father's father, is Totochitni, and that's the Bitterwater clan. It's one of the original clans of our Navajo people. I know this show is going out all over the nation online, and so I don't know exactly where it's based, but I am sitting in Washington, D.C., where I moved with my family about 4 years ago, and I just want to acknowledge that I am on the land of the Haudenosaunee and the Piscataway. These were the nations who lived in these lands around D.C. and Maryland and Virginia. These were the nations that were ethnically cleansed and removed from these lands so that the capital of this nation could be built and the states around it could be established. These are the nations that have been oppressed for centuries so that this nation could be founded. And I like to acknowledge and remember the nation whose land I'm on no matter where I go. First of all, it's very helpful to remember that these lands were not discovered. There were already nations and peoples living here long before Columbus got lost at sea. And second, it's very helpful as well as humbling to remember that these lands have a history that predate what's written in most American history books. There were societies, there were people, there were families. They were hunting here, they were fishing here, they were farming here. They were raising their children here and burying their dead here long before Columbus got lost at sea. And I like to remember that no matter where I go, so that I might walk more humbly no matter where I am around Turtle Island. In regards to your question, there's a lot of background we have to go to in order to get to the answer I gave in my response to the Democratic debate. And the background behind that is really how this nation was founded. You know, in just a few weeks, a majority of the nation is going to be memorializing and even celebrating Columbus Day. This is the day that we celebrate, our nation celebrates, that Christopher Columbus discovered America. Now, if you think about it, you cannot discover lands that are already inhabited. That process is called stealing, conquering, or colonizing. but because as a nation we honor Columbus as the discoverer of America, this reveals his implicit and our implicit racial bias as a country, was that indigenous peoples, people of color, are not fully human. See, what most people don't know is that when Columbus was leaving Spain and coming towards the New World, looking for new sea routes, he actually was armed with what was called a doctrine of discovery. The doctrine of discovery is a series of papal bulls or edicts of the Catholic Church that is essentially the church in Europe saying to the nations of Europe, wherever you go, whatever lands you find not ruled by white European Christian rulers, those people are less than human and their land is yours for the taking. So this was literally the doctrine that allowed European nations to go into Africa, colonize the continent, and enslave the people because they did not believe them to be human. It was the same doctrine that let Columbus, who again was lost at sea, land in this new world already inhabited by millions and claim to have discovered it. This doctrine in the papal bull Dum Diversus, written by Pope Nicholas V, actually said, invade, search out, capture, vanquish, and subdue all Saracens and pagans whatsoever. Reduce their persons to perpetual slavery. Convert them to his and to their use and profit. So this doctrine of discovery is a very dehumanizing white supremacist doctrine that assumes indigenous peoples and people of color are not fully human. Now, the challenge is the way this doctrine gets embedded into the foundations of our country. So in 1763, King George draws a line down the Appalachian Mountains and essentially says to the 13 colonies that were here that they no longer had the right of discovery of the empty Indian lands west of Appalachia. This upset the colonists because they wanted access to their lands, to those lands. So a few years later, they wrote a letter of protest. And in their letter, they accused the king of raising the conditions of new appropriations of land. They went on to state that he has excited domestic insurrections amongst us and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages. Now, they signed their letter on July 4th, 1776. Literally 30 lines below the statement, all men are created equal, the Declaration of Independence refers to natives as merciless Indian savages, making it very clear the only reason the Founding Fathers used that inclusive term all men is because they had a very narrow definition of who was actually human. So this makes our Declaration of Independence a systemically white supremacist document that assumes the dehumanization of indigenous peoples. A few years later, the Founding Fathers wrote another document. This one started with the words, we the people of the United States. Again, it sounds inclusive, but if you keep reading the document, Article 1, Section 2, which is a section that determines who is and who is not a part of the Union, who is and who is not covered by this Constitution. If you read Article 1, Section 2, you first will note it never mentions women, which is very important because if you read the entire Constitution from the preamble to the 27th Amendment, you will find that there are 51 gender-specific male pronouns, 51 he, him, and his, who can run for office, who can hold office, even who's protected by the document. There's not a single female pronoun in the entire Constitution. Second, Article 1, Section 2 specifically excludes natives, and third, it counts Africans as three-fifths of a person. So who's left? Well, in 1787, it was white men, and technically it was white landowning men who were allowed to vote. So again, we have to remember the reason the Constitution was working or was written, what they meant when they said, we the people of the United States, they meant white landowning men. That's who the Constitution was written to protect. That's who the Constitution was written to establish. And so today we have prisons filled with people of color. Well, this shouldn't surprise us. Our Constitution's working. We have women earning 7 to 80 cents to the dollar. This shouldn't surprise us. The Constitution's working. We have, in 2010, the Supreme Court sides with Citizens United and rules that corporations now have the same rights to political free speech as individuals, creating the door for super PACs, unlimited support for candidates. This shouldn't surprise us. The Constitution is doing exactly what it was designed to do. It's protecting the interests of white landowning men. So we don't think about this often enough, but the Constitution is another white supremacist, racist, and sexist document that assumes the white landowning male has the authority to decide who is and who is not human. So when we have a nation founded on these white supremacist, racist, and sexist documents, when you look at the history of this nation, suddenly it begins to make a lot more sense. In 1851, when Peter Burnett was governor of California, and the gold rush had just happened there, and there are thousands and thousands of prospectors pouring in, and there is a fight for the land, and there are people trying to establish and get rich. And in his first State of the State address, Peter Burnett, the first governor of California in 1851, he said that a war of extermination will continue to be waged between the races until the Indian race becomes extinct, must be expected. While we cannot anticipate this result, but with painful regret, the inevitable destiny of the race is beyond the power or wisdom of man to avert. He's not saying famine's broken out and we can't feed these people and they're going to die. And he's not saying disease has struck and we can't stop the spread of it and therefore they're going to die. He's literally saying that this nation, which just a few decades earlier declared a manifest destiny over this continent, could not stop killing Native peoples until they were extinct. In 1862, President Lincoln signed the Pacific Railway Act and a settlement act allotting 160 acres of land to anyone who goes west and settles land for 5 years. And then the Pacific Railway Act, which gives the land and the resources to complete the Transcontinental Railway, which at that point had reached Omaha, Nebraska. He was hoping to get it all the way to the West Coast. Within 3 years of signing that act, after the Dakota War of 1862 and the hanging of the Dakota 38, after the Sand Creek Massacre in Colorado, and after the Long Walk and the ethnic cleansing of the Navajo and the Mescalero Apache from New Mexico, Abraham Lincoln has literally ethnically cleansed the native tribes from the states of Minnesota, the states of Wyoming and Colorado, and the territory of New Mexico to make way for the routes of the Transcontinental Railway, making him one of the most genocidal presidents in the history of our nation. In 1892, after a massacre at Wounded Knee with 350 Dakota men, women, and children being massacred in a single day, Lakota men, women, and children being massacred in a single day, the U.S. Army awards 20 medals of honor to the U.S. soldiers who participated in this massacre. So we have this history, literally, of dehumanizing foundations and ethnic cleansing of Native peoples. And we haven't even begun to talk yet about the slavery and the Jim Crow laws and the segregation that was going on for African Americans and people who had black skin. And so when we understand this history and we see the way it's being built on top of these foundations, and that the root of them is this document known as the Doctrine of Discovery, which basically says that the natural environment, not only people of color and women, but the environment is there to be exploited and profited from by white men. That's what the Doctrine of Discovery states, for exploitation and profit. And so when we look at environmental issues, suddenly it makes sense why this nation has been destroying the environment for 500 years. One of the stories I love to tell is there's a documentary out there called Homelands. It profiles about four or five different tribes and their quest to retain sovereignty and to restore their homelands. And one of the nations, the native nations that they profile in this documentary is called, it's the Athabascan people up in Alaska and northern Canada, the people who live up near the Arctic Circle. And the leader of the Athabascan people in this documentary is telling a story about their creation story. And he says in their creation story, it's stated that there is a piece of the caribou in the human, of the caribou's heart in the human, and a piece of the human's heart in the caribou. The Athabascan people live along the migratory route of the caribou, and they have this deep, codependent, in a healthy way, relationship between the two. They depend on each other for their existence. And every year, the caribou migrate north to calf, and then every fall, they migrate south to winter, where it's a little bit warmer. And the leader of the Athabascan people was talking about this and talking about their relationship with the caribou, and he said something very striking. He said, in the spring, it doesn't matter what's going on with our people. It doesn't matter if we've had a good winter and we're healthy and we're well fed, or if we're in famine and we're starving. He said, we never hunt the caribou when they head north. If we were to begin hunting the caribou when they headed north before they had calved, we would literally be destroying ourselves, because yes, we might eat better for a few years, but ultimately we're building the house of our own demise, because eventually we're going to break this relationship and it's not going to be sustainable anymore. And so when I talk about the environment, and one of the questions they asked at the third democratic debate was, what meaningful action would you take on the environment? And the candidates all gave their varied and different responses of what they would do. And my response is, the first thing I would do, because if you look at what's going on with both the left and the right, if you listen to President Trump and the Republican Party, they're literally bragging that they have built the strongest, the greatest economy this nation has ever seen. Now, we all know that President Trump only sees things in complete binary, and it's either the greatest or the worst. And so I don't think it actually is the greatest economy our nation's ever seen, but it has been growing, and he's taking some credit for it. But he's also doing it while he's reducing environmental controls. Whether it's opening up more lands for oil, whether it's reducing clean air requirements. So they're building this economy while they are exploiting and not caring about protecting the environment. Well, if you're going to build an economy, that's the easiest way to do it. I mean, exploitation is by far the easiest way to build an economy, and they're bragging about that. But on the left, if you listen to the left, what they're saying is that they can save the economy or save the environment through this Green New Deal, and we can have a prosperous economy even while we're protecting and saving the environment. So both parties have the economy at the center of their environmental plans. Both parties are saying we can prosper still, we can continue to be wealthy and even grow our wealth and expand our prosperity while we're either destroying or protecting and saving the environment. When I listen to the story of the Athabascan people and I look at our history of our nation, we've been hunting the caribou as a nation while they head north to migrate for 500 years. This is one of the reasons we're so wealthy as a nation, because we haven't given a crap about the environment. Of course our economy is going to grow. We haven't cared for the economy well. We aren't the environment well. We've exploited it. We've profited from it, whether it's been through logging, through oil production, through wiping out of the buffalo. I mean, all these things that we've done as a nation, even through people, through slavery, of course. If you steal a continent from indigenous peoples and commit genocide against them, and then import a bunch of black people to build your nation, absolutely are you going to become wealthy. I mean, that's the recipe for wealth right there. This is what we've done. We've built wealth as a nation through the exploitation and profiting from both people and the environment. So we've been hunting the caribou as they've headed north for 500 years. And we're now at a tipping point. And there's no promise. There's no guarantee. I don't think it's a certainty that we can continue to prosper as a nation while we try to undo the damage that we've done. And we may have to learn how to live with less. We will, I'm quite certain, have to learn how to live with less. And the great thing about this is, you know, just a few weeks ago, these Gen Z high school age kids, they organized a climate strike, a global climate strike. Generation Z, kids probably sophomore in college and younger, they absolutely understand that they are inheriting a world that is on the brink of destruction. They understand that. They also don't know the world without high-speed internet. They've learned how to network. They've learned how to communicate. They've learned how to research. They've learned how to understand and gain knowledge. They don't know the world without high-speed internet. And these high school kids are amazing because they're using the resources of the internet and the ability to communicate through the internet to organize themselves. And they are saying, we're not going to take this sitting down. And they are demanding, it's these 16-year-olds who are demanding their right to vote at age 16. It's these high school kids who are leading a global climate strike to get the attention of their parents and grandparents and say, if you don't change what you're doing, there's going to be nothing for us left to inherit. And so I love what these kids are doing. I think they absolutely have the right understanding, but it's time for their parents and grandparents to step up to the plate. And rather than thinking, how much wealth can I grow so I can leave money for my children, it's time we start thinking, what do we need to do to preserve this environment so we can leave a planet for our children? I don't think Gen Z is going to be that disappointed if their parents have no money saved up for them to inherit when they die. But the planet is in a more sustainable and healthy place when they die. I think that's one of the best things that this, from what I hear from Gen Z, this is what they're looking for. They understand that they're literally fighting for their own survival. And so my first action on climate change when I come into office will not be to enact this policy or to change this. It will be to begin preparing our nation that we may need to tighten our belt. We will need to tighten our belt. We will need to make some difficult choices, and we will need to learn how to live with less. Less convenience, less prosperity, so that we can make the changes necessary. And I think I've learned over my years that if you tell people what's coming, if you prepare people to make changes and even to make sacrifices, and if you can persuade them that you're doing these things for valuable and for important reasons, people are generally able to step up to the plate. So I want to be honest with Americans. I don't want to create the illusion that we can somehow still prosper while we try to save the environment. If you're on a ship and it's sinking, the captain doesn't get on the announcement and say, please go back to your room and pack your suitcases and grab your things and come out before you get onto the lifeboat. No, they say leave everything. Come out to the lifeboats now and get in. We don't have room for all your stuff, but we can save your life. That's what we need to prepare for.
Are there any comments or questions for Mark? Thank you, Mark. That was great. From the callers or anybody here?
I just mentioned that I'm aware that this was a takeover here in this country from the Europeans, and I see it at the present going on this planet in Iraq and Iran and Afghanistan, and it's just doesn't seem to be ending for the powers that be. Unless there's somebody else that has a question or would like to mention something, I'll go to question number two from Dean Val. And this is Andrew Yang, Democratic presidential candidate, has been pushing for a federal program to research the very controversial debate over geoengineering and solar radiation management. Among the other contenders in the Democratic presidential battle, almost none of the campaigns responded to repeated requests for comment about their positions on geoengineering. We would be interested in your position on these technologies. Mark.
Well, so I have to be honest here. I looked up what they were talking about because I have not taken a stance on a lot of these things yet. But as I looked up, obviously geoengineering is pretty straightforward. Whether it's seeding rain or other things like that. But one of the things that I am deeply concerned about is this still comes from this sense of the doctrine of discovery, but it also comes from observations I've had over the past 15 years of my life regarding the distinction between power and authority. So power, if you think about that definition, power is having the ability to act. So if you have muscle, you can pick something up. Authority is the right of jurisdiction. The permission to act. Our nation is obsessed with power. There's not a day or a week that doesn't go by where someone from the government doesn't remind ourselves, our citizens, and the world that we've built the most powerful military in the history of the globe. It's daily that someone from Wall Street or someone from the finance divisions remind our citizens and the world that we have created the most wealthy financial systems in the history of the world. This nation is obsessed with power, and for power to be effective, it has to be demonstrated. One of the reasons the world listens to the United States of America is, well, two: A, we flaunt our money, and B, we're the only nation in the world to detonate nuclear bombs and actually kill civilians with them. So, of course, nations are going to listen to us. We've demonstrated we have this power and we're not afraid to use it. So a lot of nations respect that out of fear and listen to what we have to say. Now, if you listen to our political leaders and our business leaders and our military leaders, we almost never talk about authority. Again, if power is the ability to act, authority is the permission to act. We rarely talk about authority because, by and large, we don't have any. The United States of America loses its nuclear arsenal and goes bankrupt. There's hardly a nation in the world that really gives a crap what we say. We have power, but very little authority. Now, when you have power, you don't necessarily have to look at issues of authority, because if you have the power to do something, you're just inclined to go and do it. So science has also given us a ton of power. And we've used that power to understand the human genome, or the DNA sequencing. We've used that power to get medical advances. We've used that power of science to build artificial intelligence and computers, and we've gone to the moon. We've done a ton of things. But often, and because we're so obsessed with power, we are very good at asking, can we do something? We are not very good at asking, should we do something? Again, because typically when you're obsessed with power and you have a lot of power, your focus is on what can I do, and it's not necessarily on what should I do. I've done some research in my life on time perception. And the Western world lives in a linear perception of time, where there's a definite starting point and an ending point. And as you move across the timeline, you pass certain events. And once you pass an event, it's over. You're not allowed to go back. This fact that you can't go back in time creates a tension in people who live in a linear perception of time. And so they make a schedule so that they don't miss anything. So the way they organize their life is they live their life according to the schedule, and the way they honor and value people is they honor and value the schedule. The Navajo perception of time and many indigenous perceptions of time are not linear but circular. And as you go around the circle, you still pass events, but if you miss something or go past it, you don't worry about it near as much because eventually it's going to come back around again. And so the way that we organize our lives in a circular perception of time is not by making a schedule, but by completing a task. So you work on something not till the bell rings, but until you complete the task. And so the way we show honor and value and importance is not by being there when something starts, but by staying until it finishes, until you complete the task. Now, it's not that one perception is good and one perception is bad, one perception is right or one perception is wrong. They're just different. They're different perceptions of time. When I've observed these perceptions of time, one of the dangers of the linear perception of time is it gives you the illusion that you're in control. One of the challenges with a circular perception of time is that it's not very efficient because you're not concerned as much about time as you're concerned about completing the task. And so when you have a culture, a worldview, society that not only is obsessed with power, but has a linear perception of time, it creates this illusion that you can control things, and not only that you can control things, that you actually can't. When I lived back on the reservation, one of the traditions of our Navajo people is we would rise every morning and you would run to the east and you would greet the morning sunrise with your prayers. And when I moved back there, and I lived there for 11 years, almost every morning, probably 5 to 6 mornings a week, I would rise and I would walk outside our hogan and I would look towards the east, and I would greet the morning sunrise with my prayers. Now, when you watch a sunrise once, it's beautiful. You know, most Americans may see one when they have an early flight, or maybe if they're Christian, they'll see one on Easter morning on a sunrise service or something. And whenever you see a sunrise, and if the clouds are right and the sky is clear, it's very beautiful, breathtaking even. But when you rise 5 or 6 days a week and you watch the sunrise every day, and then you watch it every week, and then your weeks turn into months and your months turn into years, you watch the grass grow and the flowers bloom, you see the sun slowly moving north and then once again back south, you see the birds and the animals migrating in the direction of the sun. You see the rain come. You see the fall colors. You see the winter and the snow. You see things dying off and then growing again in the spring. And you see this as you do this day after day, month after month, week after week, year after year. It no longer becomes just about the beauty of the sunrise. but it speaks something very deep to your soul, which is that you're not in control. You can't control the migration of the animals. You can't stop the sun. You can't halt the spinning of the globe. You can't make winter come or spring go away. And the more you do this, and when your months turn into years and your years even turn into decades, you begin to actually feel very much at peace, knowing you're not in control, knowing that there are systems and mechanisms that are taking place that you cannot and should not be in control of. For three of the years that we lived on the reservation, we were in a hogan, traditional Navajo dwelling. We were 6 miles off the nearest paved road on a dirt road, no running water, no electricity. The community we lived in, our neighbors were rug weavers and shepherds. And as we lived there, one of the first things we had to teach our son, who was about 3 years old when we moved there, is that water's not a plaything. Water's not a toy. When you have to haul your water, it suddenly becomes very valuable, and you don't play with it. You don't waste it. You don't let the faucet run. You don't just dump the water out. It's a precious resource. When you have to get up in the middle of the night to build a fire, you suddenly become concerned about how well is your home insulated, how efficient can you keep the heat in or keep the cold out, or in the summer, keep the cool inside. And you begin thinking about all of these things. And so living there, you know, one of the things I'm convinced of, where we have people today in denial of climate change, I'm absolutely convinced, if we did not have air conditioners, if that technology had never been invented, there would not be a debate over climate change. If we didn't have electric lights and televisions, there would not be a debate over climate change. Air conditioners, lights, all these things, they remove us from the environment. You know, I now live in Washington, D.C. I travel frequently to New York City. You can literally spend weeks, even months, in these cities without ever touching dirt. Every road is paved. Every sidewalk has cement on it. Every yard is manicured. You could literally go days, weeks, months without ever touching the dirt. Now, I'm not saying air conditioners are bad. I'm not saying paved roads are bad. I'm not saying sidewalks are bad. But what these things do is they remove us from our environment. They remove us, and they put us in this bubble where we begin to believe that our existence is not dependent on the environment. You could live in New York City and never see the dirt, never see plants growing in the ground, never have to plant your own food or hunt your own meat. And you could just waste it and exploit it and not care about it until that resource ran out. And so the more our technology removes us from the daily experience of interacting with the actual raw materials of our environment, the more we end up not worrying about it. When we lived in this hogan where we didn't have running water, we maybe used, between a family of three at that point, my wife and my son and I, we maybe used 10 gallons of water, maybe 15 gallons of water a day on a very busy day. Most days we probably use between 7 and 8 gallons of water a day. I don't know what the use for an average household in America is, but I guarantee you, with the flushing toilets and the running faucets and the dishes and the manicured lawns and the plants and the dripping faucets, I guarantee you it's more than 5 to 7 gallons a day. Is it great that we have running water? Absolutely. But it removes the convenience of having running water, makes us not understand how precious of a resource this is, and how we should be working hard to conserve it. And so when we start thinking about geoengineering, when we start thinking about what if we could begin seeding rain and controlling weather and manipulating our environment, not for just one person, but for entire communities. The question is not, can we do that? That's an easy question. The question is, should we do that? And when we live in a world where the vast majority of the resources and the financial wealth lies in the hands of just a few people, we have already demonstrated when we can control something, we do not do a good job of distributing it equally. There's not an unlimited supply of rain in the clouds. If we seed rain in one area, we're removing rain from another area. Do you think that human beings should be in charge of controlling where it rains? We can't even distribute education equally. Do you think for a moment we would distribute rain equally? We can't even distribute money equally. Do you think we would distribute rain equally? No. The question is not, can we do geoengineering? The question is, should we? No, we shouldn't. No, we shouldn't. We have not demonstrated yet that we have the controls, that we have learned to control ourselves to the point where we can manipulate. And I would argue we don't understand the complexity of the environment well enough to understand what happens if we begin seeding rain in this place and removing rain from that place, and not effect that will have in a decade from now, but what effect that will have a few centuries from now. Again, we live in this Western culture that is so focused on the individual. Most families are lucky if they can think one generation back and one generation ahead of themselves. And this is where we need the wisdom of our indigenous peoples who look seven generations back and seven generations forward. We have to understand what we're doing today. Not only how is it going to affect our children, how is it going to affect our children's grandchildren's 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 grandchildren? I don't yet trust us enough to begin geoengineering. I think we will find the same thing we found, what we've done with oil and with other aspects of our natural environment, which is we're beginning to hunt the caribou as they're migrating north. And we feel like we're getting fat and we're eating well, so this must be a good thing, because we don't understand how this is actually destroying this way of life and this ability to exist and subsist. Not for our children, but for our children's grandchildren's 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 grandchildren. So I would be very, very hesitant. I don't think our I know our nation and most nations around the world have not demonstrated that we have not the power to not do these things, but the wisdom to really ask, should we do these things? That's the key question. And I haven't seen evidence that we are able to make those decisions as humans yet. I think it'd be better if we could just acknowledge there's some things we're not in control of, not because we can't do them, but because once we do them, we don't know how to control them. And we don't know how to distribute them in a just and healthy and way that allows us to subsist.
Thanks, Mark. It's sounds good to me. I don't know if we have Dwayne Hepner available yet.
So you can keep up.
He'll be in at about 3:15.
Oh, okay. I have a couple I have a question, or I guess it's two parts. What do you intend to do if you're president of the United States, and how are you going to get others to agree with you?
Are you asking what my strategy is or what my vision is? I'm not quite sure what you're asking.
Yeah, if you're the president, you have the power now and the authority in this physical realm to do what your visions are. What are they? What would you start doing? And how would you get others to agree to do those things?
At the heart of my vision, the theme of my campaign, is I'm advocating that we should build a nation where we the people truly means all the people. In his last State of the Union, President Obama was talking about our need for a new politics. And he quoted the Constitution. He said, "We the people, our Constitution begins with these three simple words. Words we've come to recognize mean all the people." I heard that, and he got a lot of applause for that line. But when I heard that, I looked around. I asked myself, I said, when did we decide this? The founding fathers did not believe we the people meant all the people. Abraham Lincoln, who was a blatant white supremacist and one of our most genocidal presidents, did not believe we the people meant all the people. The civil rights movement, as good as it was, did not get us to we the people meaning all the people. Having a black president didn't get us to we the people means all the people. Donald Trump definitely does not believe we the people means all the people. The challenge is that we've never decided as a nation that we want to be a place where we the people means all the people. And so this is the conversation. You know, we've been having this debate for at least the past 10 years. You know, in 2016, President Trump won by telling America that let's make America great again. Hillary Clinton responded in 2016 by saying, America's already great. At the Democratic National Convention, President Obama jumped into the fray and said, America's pretty great already. And then Cory Booker, African-American senator from New Jersey, he's now running for president. He was a rising star in 2016. He's on the main stage of the DNC. He's endorsing Hillary Clinton. And in his speech, he acknowledges that the Declaration refers to natives as savages. He acknowledges that the Constitution excludes women. He acknowledges that there was a three-fifths compromise dehumanizing African people. But he ended that section of his speech. Now, he was very courageous in saying that, more courageous than almost every politician who doesn't acknowledge these flaws in our foundation. But he saved his political ambitions by closing that section of his speech and telling the audience that, but these things do not detract from our nation's greatness. So if we have Donald Trump saying Make America Great Again, and the Democrats saying America is great already, we have African-American senators saying our history of slavery and Jim Crow laws and genocide doesn't detract from our greatness. So if Donald Trump says America is great in the So if we have Donald Trump saying America's, let's make America great again, and the Democrats saying America's great already, they both agree our past, our history, our foundations are great. They disagreed if we were great in 2016. Donald said no, and Hillary said yes. See, most Americans thought that in 2016 we were having a debate over racism versus anti-racism or equality versus inequality, but we weren't. The question we were asking ourselves was, do we want Donald Trump and the Republicans to make us explicitly white supremacist, racist, and sexist again, or do we want Hillary Clinton and the Democrats to keep our white supremacy and racism implicit? And we voted for implicit because Hillary got the majority of the votes, and our white supremacist and racist electoral college gave us explicit. And so we've never decided as a nation that we the people means all the people. We've never decided as a nation, rather than talking about when we were last great or how soon we might be great again, we've never answered the question, do we just want to treat everybody as human? And that's the conversation I think we need to have as a country. And that's the conversation that I'm trying to bring through my campaign. Now, once I'm elected, one of my key planks of my platform is that the United States of America needs a national dialogue on race, gender, and class. A conversation that I would put on par with the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions that happened in South Africa, in Rwanda, and in Canada. I wouldn't call ours reconciliation, though, because reconciliation implies there was a previous harmony, which is not true. A much more appropriate term would be truth and conciliation, because conciliation is merely the mediation of a dispute. If reconciliation perpetuates the myth, we used to be great, now we're not, conciliation lets us start at a much more honest starting point. This thing began as a mess, we're just trying to make it better. When South Africa had their TRC a little over 25 years ago, they ended up writing an entirely new constitution. When Canada concluded their TRC a few years ago over the issue of residential schools or boarding schools for their native population, their commission gave 93 recommendations to the government and the churches of what they needed to do to live into this commitment to heal this history. And so this is where I'm saying, this is the dialogue our nations need to have. Do we want to be a nation where we the people truly means all the people? And if so, we have to deal with our foundations. We have to talk about the racism, the sexism, the white supremacy that's embedded into our founding documents. And if we can solve it there and make the decisions there, that will help us in creating a better reality for our current times. Now, I also am very aware of the fact that the president, contrary to what President Trump believes or appears to believe, the president is not the king. We have three co-equal branches of government. And we live, at least we like to call it, a democracy where everybody has a vote. Now, we've never had a true democracy. Even if you go back to the Constitution, Article 1, Section 2, which is where they're establishing the Electoral College, and the three-fifths compromise that they had back then, you know, they were debating over how to count black people. The South wanted to count black persons as a whole, and the North wanted to count them as much less. Why? Well, because the South had more black people, and so if they had more black people, then they could have greater representation. The North had less black people, so they didn't want to count black people as much because that would then even the odds. Now, they weren't saying who could vote. That wasn't the question they were asking. They were saying, how do we let these people? No, they had already, both sides agreed black people wouldn't vote. Abraham Lincoln had no interest in letting black people vote. He said that over and over. They were debating how should they be counted for representation. See, what they were trying to do with the Electoral College was to maximize the number of people that were represented while they minimized the number of people who could actually do the representing. The whole point of the Electoral College is gerrymandering. That's why we have an Electoral College. In the last election, President Trump said that he won the greatest Electoral College victory in the history of our nation. That's not true at all. He won. The reason he won is why we have an Electoral College in the first place. This is why we have it. The Electoral College exists so that the white landowning male, even if he gets 3 million votes less than the non-white landowning male, whether it be a woman or a person of color, he will still win. Wasn't the greatest Electoral College victory in the history of the world. This is why we have an Electoral College in the first place, to ensure that someone like Donald Trump beats a candidate like Hillary Clinton, who is a woman. And so, but we have at least a semblance of a value for democracy. And one of the things we've lost, because we've constructed this two-party system, and I'm not running as a Democrat or a Republican, I'm running as an independent. And one of the challenges of our two-party system is it literally makes every talking point binary. And it puts a polar opposite on nearly every discussion. Makes every dialogue binary. Now, we live in a very complex, diverse world. And if we reduce every single problem down to a single binary, we're going to miss a ton of stuff. And so our simplistic, elementary, two-party political system actually doesn't allow us to solve complex problems. It just allows us to scream at each other and to blame. The two sides can blame each other, but neither side is really interested in solving the problem. Let me give you an example. Immigration reform. It was George Bush back in the early 2000s who began our most recent cycle of dialogue regarding immigration reform. He introduced it. This was back in the early 2000s, soon after he got into office. Since that time, both the Democrats and the Republicans at the same time have had a majority in the House and the Senate and the White House. Over the last 20 years, both the Democrats and the Republicans at one point or another had the majority in the House, the Senate, and the White House. And neither side passed immigration reform. They're not interested in solving the problem. They're interested in screaming at each other. Right now, the Democrats are screaming at the Republicans for what's going on at the border, where not that long ago, many of these Democrats were in support of some kind of wall or fortification for our borders. If you look at the deportation rates of the Obama administration and his catch and release numbers, they're astronomical compared to what's going on today. See, this is the problem. What we've done is we've politicized an issue, immigration reform. We've made the entire dialogue binary. Neither side is interested or has the authority to fix the problem. And so it just creates something that they can scream at each other for. Around the time when President Bush brought up immigration reform back in the early 2000s, I was living on the reservation, and I was out herding sheep one day with one of my neighbors, and we were walking through the field, and he was a boarding school survivor and had lived on the reservation most of his life. He speaks better Navajo than English, and we're walking through the fields herding sheep, and I said to him, I said, you know, the nation's talking about immigration reform. I'm curious, what's your thoughts on the matter? And he said to me, he said, well, there's already so many of them here. Maybe we shouldn't worry about borders anymore. Now, if you're anywhere else in the country, you immediately think he's talking about the 14 million undocumented that have come over the southern border. But because we're both native, because we're on a reservation, because he's a boarding school survivor, you have to at least pause and ask, is he talking about the 14 million undocumented over the southern border? Are the 300 million undocumented who have been pouring in since 1492? And I love the ambiguity so much I didn't even ask him to clarify. And since that point, I began talking about and even teaching that without natives at the table, the United States of America is incapable of comprehensively and justly reforming immigration law. Without the indigenous hosts of Turtle Island in the dialogue, all you have is one generation of undocumented immigrants trying to figure out what to do with another generation of undocumented immigrants. And there's no integrity, there's no authority in the conversation. Doesn't matter if you're building a wall to keep people out or you're trying to tear one down to let people in. If you do not have the host people of the land, the indigenous peoples of the land, the people that you try to ethnically cleanse and remove from the land, if you do not have their voice in the conversation, you have no authority to do either. Now, that's a much too nuanced conversation for either the Democrats or the Republicans to bring to the table. That's a conversation that is going to require, it's not a binary solution. And so we're incapable as a nation of having it, which is why I'm running as an independent. So that I can actually bring in the discussion, introduce it without a party telling me we can't talk about those things. And I can begin to draw people in from both sides and say, let's find a way to talk about it. Let's actually begin to discuss these things and try to persuade rather than just bludgeoning each other over the heads with our arguments. So our simplistic two-party system has made every dialogue binary, and it's reduced us to just screaming at each other. And we're in a time where we need wise, educated, thoughtful leaders who are able to listen to a diversity of opinions and thoughts and ideas. And not just pick the best one, but actually begin the art of crafting and molding and persuading these arguments. In Native circles, we call it a talking circle, where you'll sit in a circle and you have a talking stick or a feather or something else of sacred importance, and you'll pass it around. And when you receive the talking stick, you have the opportunity to talk and to share. Some people may pass it and let someone else talk. Others may keep it and say what they want to say. But everyone is not only given the opportunity to speak, but they're given everyone also has the opportunity to hear everyone else's argument. And many of our decisions are not made by a vote or by a majority rule, but by consensus, where you talk about things until you come to a consensus. that doesn't work well when you only have two people in the dialogue. When every dialogue is binary, when every issue is good or bad, right or wrong, it's very difficult to, and you're not able to listen to each other. It's very hard to build a consensus. And so when I'm president, my goal will be to not only do a lot of listening, but to invite a lot of different voices into the conversations. I would love to see us have a political debate, much like we used to have, where the candidates could talk for 45 minutes to an hour and give a full speech. Instead, we've reduced our campaign debates down to 90-second sound bites. And we're expecting our candidates to articulate their positions on environment and racism and gun control and economy in 30 to 90-second sound bites that can then be turned into a meme and used to inflame people from one side or the other. But what if we actually got used again to nuanced, thoughtful dialogue, where we could actually have the space to lay out an argument and build on it, and then have people give them a chance to respond to it? That'd be a very good thing. And that's one thing I hope to bring into the White House.
Thanks, Mark. Does anybody have any questions for Mark or something they'd like to say?
Yeah, I do, Tim. This is Mike Mason. I'm just curious, Tim. Yeah. Have you ever considered the possibility that you may have been here before and taken part in some of these terrible injustices that you've been so correctly identifying?
You're asking me?
Yeah, I'm talking to you.
That I've been here before, I'm not sure what you're talking about. Are you talking about reincarnation?
Well, yeah, exactly. Have you ever considered the possibility that you may have been here before and actually been involved and taken part in some of these injustices that you're now identifying?
No, I don't. I don't believe in reincarnation.
Good enough.
Thanks, Mike and Mark. Dwayne is back. And again, Mark, Dwayne is the founder of the Wonderful Worldwide Educators nonprofit. It's an educational environmental group. And so far, what he's heard, he agrees with a lot of what you're saying, particularly the solar radiation management, the geoengineering, that anything we do as humans to add to nature usually becomes distorted. So do we really need it? So I think Dwayne agrees with you in that respect. Here's Dwayne right now.
Hello, Mark. Thank you very much for joining us as Worldwide Educators, because we're just trying to, do our little part to share with the world. And so thank you very much for stepping up. You're very brave. We ask many people to have interviews with us, and many times they're reluctant, but we're just all about the all-natural environment and supporting it, and see it as very important. And looking back 300 years, when the cowboy and Indian days to now, things have changed really radically, and are they really getting better? So it's very important to look at all this, isn't it?
Yes, I would agree. Thank you for having me on the show.
Yes, well, thank you very much. Yes, we do a whole lot. I'm a writer myself. I was a general contractor for 40 years. Then I got into the humanitarian programs, and I'm doing things worldwide, et cetera, setting up different projects because this is my adventure also. And and my friend Val here and Eric and Kelsey Brown and others. We do a whole lot on Facebook. I've got about almost 2,000 groups there, about 4,000 titles on lulu.com, et cetera. And so I'm very prolific at what I do, and I'm very concerned. And so I've signed up myself like you have, and to see how this adventure comes out with this presidential idea. So, but the biggest part is just to, let people know what's going on in the world, because it's very, very real. And we have a lot more challenges coming up here with the 5G and things like this and what's going on, et cetera. So it's a lot bigger picture than most people realize, more than just the marketing of things.
Yeah. Yeah. So are you running, did I hear correctly, you're running in the Green Party?
Well, we looked at all of them. I thought about creating my own, but then I thought, oh, I got plenty to do as it is. So to do that would be a lot. So it was just easier to sign up with them. There's the idea there. There's that and a lot more. And anything that I can contribute help with, help people understand what's going on, because we all have our own experiences, and I see that as very important. And it's like the animals and the birds and the past, the Indians, they didn't destroy the natural environment, and everything seems to be chasing money and progress. Well, there's many ways to do that, but we're coming to a point where, everything's poisoned and polluted, and it's really time to look at things more than just, putting on events and political speeches and sound good words, but actually doing something. And it's going to take a lot, and I see it as all as agreement, and as long as people are agreeing, well, then things go on. They can be good people, but they're still agreeing to what's taking place. So agreement is a huge thing to look at and to really understand. So it's not necessarily, I don't see petitioning those that, rule society so much, but that as people decide differently and they recognize what they're agreeing to, that's very important, then there can be a change.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So how has your campaign been going?
Well, I'm just casually doing it because I have other things that I'm doing, and this is just part of it, again, to let people know it's another avenue to let people know about paying attention to the environment more than just recycling their soda cans. And so that's mm-hmm. a cute idea, but that's not going to do it. So there's a lot more going on. There's a lot to understand. I'm learning myself all the time. So my campaign is really with the wonderful worldwide educators and what we're doing, and sharing what's going on with the all natural environment in many areas, many levels, et cetera. So that becomes a bigger adventure for people to understand.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yes, just all it entails everything. So, and anything that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yes, sir. So with that said, you're wonderful. Thank you again for showing up. Good luck to you. We'll see you out there. And here's Val.
Thank you. It's good to meet you.
Yeah, great, Mark. You make a lot of sense. I'm just, a lot of politicians are out there just talking their talk, and you seem to be a lot more real with what's going on with the world right now as it is, and not just giving a speech. And so we really appreciate that you're so real about present events. It's really about what's going on now, and then you're addressing that the best you can. So,
yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no, go ahead. I was going to give it back to Tim when you're done.
I was going to say, really at the center of what I'm trying to do is there's a native leader from the Dene people in Canada. His name is George Erasmus. And he says that where common memory is lacking and where people do not share in the same past, there can be no real community. if you want to build a community, he said, you have to start by creating common memory. I love that quote. I think it's genius. It gets heart to the heart of our nation's problem with race, gender, and class, which is we don't have a common memory. We have a white majority that remembers a mythological history of discovery and expansion, opportunity and exceptionalism. And we have communities of color, we have women, we have LGBTQ, we have these other minority communities that have the lived experience of stolen lands and broken treaties, slavery and Jim Crow laws, boarding schools and Indian massacres. We have white nationalist terrorism. We have internment camps. We have segregation. And we have families being separated at the borders. And there's no common memory. And community is really at a very low point right now, you know, whether it's politically or religiously or economically. We've lost our ability to communicate and to be in community with one another. And so one of the things I'm trying to do on a really broad scale is to create space for this common memory, to teach this common memory, because I'm convinced that in doing this, in leading into this dialogue on race, gender, and class, this Truth and Conciliation Commission, in not only just campaigning for president, but by teaching our history and helping people to understand how the problems and the challenges we're facing today are not current to the day only. They're rooted in what's in our history that has been unresolved or never been addressed or never been remembered. And so if we really want to solve these problems, we want to create better community, we have to build this common memory and begin to deal with our past. Now, I have a book coming out in a few days. I actually just got my first copy of it in the mail the other day. It's called Unsettling Truth, The Ongoing Dehumanizing Legacy of the Doctrine of Discovery. And it lays out a lot of this history, and it's a critique of both the nation and the church, and how not only was this doctrine of discovery written, but what impact and influence it's had on our nation as a whole. It will be due in bookstores on November 5th, but it really is, it's not the sum of everything I talk about, but it is a very good collection of what I'm trying to address and what is it that we need to find a way to move forward as a group of people.
Great, Mark. Thanks. Yes, it would be a wonderful thing if people became aware of what really makes sense to survive and enjoy, or whatever you want to call it, have a life that is something that is valued for everyone. Does anyone else have any questions for Mark or something they'd like to say? Or Mark, do you have anything else you'd like to mention?
Well, if people want to learn more about my campaign, they can go to my website, which is markcharles2020.com. And on my website, I have a 9-minute announcement video where I lay out in this video my assessment of the challenges we're facing and my proposals of what we need to do to move forward. It's a video that really kind of captures the heart of what we've been talking about some today, not with the environment per se, but with the bigger picture of the entire nation. And I encourage people to go to my website. They can learn more about my campaign. As we said earlier, we mentioned earlier, after the last Democratic debate in Houston, I filmed a 2-hour webinar where I responded to many of the same questions and issues that were brought up during that debate. And I laid those out. So we talked about foreign policy. We talked about the environment. We talked about immigration reform. We talked about gun control. We talked about racism. And that video is up on my website and at my YouTube channel. And you can also follow me online. We have a Facebook page under Mark Charles 2020. And then my personal
social media, which is Wireless Hogan, WIRELESSHOGAN. That's my handle on Twitter. And on Facebook, my handle is Mark Charles Wireless Hogan. That's my professional page on Facebook. And then Instagram is also Wireless Hogan. So I'm, my campaign and myself personally is out on social media pretty heavily, and people can learn more about what I'm doing, learn more about my campaign. They can follow up there. They can contact us. They can donate to our campaign, anything they want to do from our website and from our social media. So it's been a pleasure to be with you. And I thank you for giving me the space to talk about some of these issues, especially around the environment, because I think they are definitely issues that we need to begin addressing. And we have to find a way to talk about the entirety of the problem, and to prepare our nation and the world for the decisions we have to make if we're going to survive and move forward.
Well, thank you for being with us, Mark, and good luck. Unless somebody else has something that they'd like to ask or say, we'll just end the show.
Thank you, Mark, again, from Dean Val and Dwayne. Really appreciate it. I appreciate that you're real and sincere about what you're doing, and good luck with your journey.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And if we have a few minutes, I just want to make sure people understand that I'm not running a protest campaign. You know, I'm not just trying to raise issues. I'm not just trying to change the dialogue. If I were doing that, I probably would have run as a Democrat. You know, I could have raised more money. I could have gotten into the debates. I could have gotten more publicity. But I never would have been nominated. The Democratic Party never would have nominated me. The same with the Republican Party. Running as an independent is probably the most difficult path to the White House. You have to get on the ballot in all 50 states. Our press does not really see or acknowledge independent candidates. So running as an independent has a host of challenges, as well as the fact that I'm Native and I'm coming with this very strong critique of our foundations and what needs to happen. You know, these are all very difficult challenges to get to the White House, but running as an independent is the only path that actually lets me get there. And so, I want people to understand that I'm not running a protest campaign. I am running because I absolutely believe I am the most qualified person to do this job. And I believe I have a vision that can actually help move our nation forward. And I am running with this campaign because I am prepared to win. I know it's going to be a long shot, but we have a strategy that actually allows us that actually has a path for us to actually get to the White House. And so I invite people to continue following my campaign, to continue engaging with me on these issues, to listening to the things that we put out. And, I've been very, very grateful for the opportunities I've had, not just to do interviews and podcasts like this, but for all the opportunities I've been able to do. There was actually a Native forum just a few weeks ago. It was in the end of August, the third week of August. It was the Frank Lemire Native American Presidential Forum. It was only the second Native American Presidential Forum in the history of our nation, and the first forum that actually had top-tier candidates. There were 10 Democratic candidates and myself at the forum: Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, Julian Castro, several of the top Democratic candidates were there, and then I was there. And it gave us a chance to address issues from Native elders, from Native youth, from Native leaders, and to talk about the role of Native America as a voting bloc, but also the issues of Native Americans that need to be addressed in our nation. And it was a wonderful opportunity for me to be on the same stage as the other Democratic candidates, and to really demonstrate, not only for the people who were there, but for the press who were in attendance, that this is a very viable campaign. Esquire wrote an article after that campaign, and their article was titled, "Elizabeth Warren was well received at the Native American Forum, but Mark Charles was the main event." And so it was wonderful to hear people and see the press acknowledge not only my understanding of the issues, but my ability to communicate to them and actually to connect with voters and communicate the values and the vision that I have for our country. So, yeah, thank you for the opportunity to speak to your audience. Thank you for the opportunity to address environmental issues. And I am very excited about the next 15 months as we go into the end of 2019 and move into 2020 and move past and through the primary and into the general election. So I'm in this journey for the long haul, and I'm looking forward to seeing what happens. So a kiahat, and in Navajo we would say hakonet, which does not mean goodbye. It means we will see you later.
Thanks again, Mark, and see you later. I guess, unless anybody else has something they'd want to mention, I'll end the show with singing a song to try to get the real connection to real guidance and a real education. New you. See everybody.
Hakonet.